Blog Talk
Good evening,
Radio.
Ladies and gentlemen. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. This is Chaim Schmidt from The Kosher Scene. Our guest tonight on this our inaugural show on Blog Talk Radio is Kim Amzalag, the Director of Sales and Marketing at Kosher Inspired Magazine. Kim, are you there?
Hey, tonight.
Kim,
Hi,
are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Hi,
how
are
you?
All right, Baruch Hashem. So, tell us a little bit how you got into the magazine business.
Well, I first started, ironically, working for a radio show, and that radio program in Boston was called Weather Information Talk and Sports. So it's funny that tonight we're going to be discussing how I entered the magazine world when my first start in advertising was in the radio world. So I think that's pretty funny.
Yes, it is.
And now, after I came to New York, I worked in the travel industry, and I made my way walking past the Condé Nast building and eventually went to work. My first job 20 years ago was representing all the Jewish media in the country. So all the national magazines like Hadassah and Moment Magazine, Reform Judaism, Lilith, and even Jewish Action and Jewish Homemaker, the OK from Rabbi Levy.
Right.
So I started in Jewish media 20 years ago, and I learned very well that target niche media was, you know, very, very important to the world of Kraft General Foods and Maxwell House Coffee and Lender's Bagels, and many other brands who were making their name and had made their names for two generations with the Jewish community. First, when they came here speaking Yiddish, and then when they migrated into more Anglo-speaking publications, they went from the Jewish Vorwärts in Yiddish to the Jewish Week and the Jewish Press and the Philadelphia Jewish Exponent and the all the publications around the country that serviced the Jewish communities. Then I left the Jewish media, and I went off to a career in mainstream media, you might say, GQ, Bride, Travel and Leisure Golf, Sever, and then I ended up at all the magazines and everything I did in my career, though, were highly, highly targeted. The bride who had bride brain, you know, she could only think about her wedding. The CEO golfer who could only think about golf, and the Sever, you know, the very avid cook and chef who loved and
right.
filled the pages of Sever magazine for the, you know, the big foodies. And all along...
Yes, but they stopped the print publication. They are now only on the web.
Yes, but that's a recent phenomenon. And, you know, it's interesting that you say that because I recently saw an ad for Condé Nast. I think it was the Magazine Publishers Association. They had an ad in Oprah Winfrey's magazine, O. And the headline said, "We surf the internet, we swim in magazines." Basically, the gist of it was, right, you know, the internet's exhilarating, and magazines are enveloping, and the internet grabs you, and magazines embrace you. The internet is impulsive, and magazines are immersive, and both media are growing. And what happened is that just because there was a new medium didn't mean that magazines completely disappeared. So, in fact, since the 12-year life of Google, magazine readership actually increased 11%. So, you know, movies didn't kill radio and TV didn't kill movies, and an established medium can continue to flourish so long as it continues to offer a unique experience. And reader loyalty and growth, you know, magazines prove that that can happen. And I think that's why people are not giving up on swimming, and they're also enjoying surfing the net and magazines.
Very good. Now, you've mentioned the magazines like Sever and GQ. What exactly did you do for them? Was it also advertising and sales?
Yes. I just got a taste recently of my first experience on the editorial side of things. And as you know, that since that's how we met, when I was doing a shoot here in my house, for a Moroccan Mimouna, which we hope will feature in the next issue of Kosher Inspired. But I've always spent my entire career on the business side of the magazine. And for, you know, the readers out there who don't know it, a magazine is always comprised of two parts: the words and pictures, which are called editorial,
right,
and then the business side of the magazine, which is the revenue from advertising and circulation.
Right.
So now the third part is that they've introduced the internet and try to engage readers that way as well. So my career has always been in advertising, sales, and marketing, but to a very targeted niche group of readers. So
yes, I noticed
that.
None of the magazines were general magazines. They were always specialized magazines.
Very niche, very highly targeted.
Before we talk about the Kosher Inspired, tell us a little bit about your stint at Saver.
Well, you know, it's funny because Saver was a fabulous cooking magazine. They would do 12 pages on saffron, and they talked about how the Polish people would do pickling and the Russians.
Right.
And I saw that the migratory route of food was definitely, you know, where Jews lived, they were highly influenced by the, you know, customs and the foods that were available. For example, my husband is from Morocco, and they had abundant vegetables and fruits, so their cuisine was very different. The Eastern European Jews who had to pickle things, and they made things like beet borscht because that's how they could preserve the beets and what was available to them. So that's,
hello?
I was always on the advertising side, even when I was at Saver. And, you know, but I always remember that we had to substitute out and sort of hop, skip, and jump over the pork and the shellfish and the non-kosher, you know, items. But they always, even when Saver was writing about, let's say, the community of Strasbourg in France, they would talk about choucroute. And they talked about the way that the Jews adapted something that was definitely not kosher into a kosher specialty. So, I learned a lot at my time at Saver, and I continue to take and draw from every place that I've ever worked in advertising to what I'm doing now.
Now, you were saying that the magazine subscriptions have increased, but at the same time, I have a question for you. For example, the realm of food. Saver Magazine in print, Gourmet Magazine, which are the greatest magazines ever.
Right, and is now out of business.
Right.
Shockingly.
What exactly is going on? Beautiful magazine. In fact, I picked up a couple of 6 years of writing edited by the last editor, Ruth, and the writing is incredible. It isn't just about food. In Paris, describing some village in Italy, you can almost feel that you're there. You can almost hear the sound. And yet, people are no longer going for what happened.
I hear it all the time, Chaim, right now, when people say that they read the magazine and of Kosher Inspired, and they're cooking from it. They made Lavana's soups. They are making the recipes. I heard somebody just tell me last week they made the Moroccan fish soup, and that was from our second issue. I heard yesterday somebody said, I'm making that Persian souda. It better be good. I said, I don't know. It looks good, but my husband's Moroccan. I really don't know much about Persian food and how to prepare it. So people are taking the magazine, and they're cooking from it, and they're experiencing it, but I think they like the tactile experience of turning the pages, seeing the finished product, seeing the step-by-step. For example, the cover story of this issue, the Purim issue, had a great story by Paula Scheuer, the author of The Kosher Baker, about macarons. And the macarons,
right,
we showed the beautiful color
right
macarons, but inside we showed it step-by-step. And I think that Lavana, who I think is out there listening tonight, she also takes the reader and the novice cook as well as the experienced cook on a journey of her own personal food journey, but also holds their hand to get the job done so that there's not an intimidation factor. And I don't really think that can happen on the Internet. And my own theory about why gourmet went out of business, Chaim, what I've heard in the industry, because it was as shocking to me as it was to anybody who had read and enjoyed Gourmet magazine for the last how many years? I know that it was a formidable competitor to me when I was at Saveur magazine. What I've heard is the reason it went out of business is because it had poor management, and now Condé Nast is taking some of that information and they're aggregating it in different places. So we don't really always know why a magazine has the plug pulled, but I certainly think that as the shakeout of the economy and people, you know, going to the Internet to get information continues, there's no question we're more efficient. I wouldn't read a newspaper when I can get that kind of information off the Internet. But a food magazine, I think, has a more personal experience. People want to read it before they go to sleep, get ideas, plan menus. You flip through, you get ideas, and you're holding something in your hand. And I don't think that will ever go away.
Well, as a matter of fact, you're right. Holding something in your hand is today the age when so many people are reading for similar devices. I cannot imagine, perhaps, that showing my age, but holding a Kindle instead of a book in my hand for a magazine.
I think that there is a technological
factor. The Internet a lot allows me to download magazines. Yes, it looks like I'm flipping the pages and all that. It's not with a real magazine, paper magazine. Kim?
Yes, I'm here. And, you know, I agree with that, but I think that even at the younger generation, because I, too, grew up reading and enjoying and having the pleasure of flipping through magazines. And they weren't food magazines. When I was younger, they were fashion magazines or whatever, you know, what my own personal interests were. But our generation is not the only one. I think the younger generation also, as a backlash to the technology barrage, they want a tactile experience. I have a daughter who's a very avid book reader. She's not giving up her books. Even if she gets a Kindle, which she does not have now, she likes to have her books, and there's an ownership over it, and there's an experience you have with it. And I think books are more intense than magazines, but I think if the reader of the magazine is connected to by the editorial and the editors really know who their audience is, then that same kind of connection can happen. And also, you know, we work and we have home. And then we have what I like to call the third space, and that's the place where people relax, they unwind, they enjoy their passion, and that is the place of connection. And I think a magazine does that better than almost any other medium. And they've written off magazines now for 30 years, and they're still here. So, Chaim, I think that's, you know, I hope that answers your question.
Yes, it definitely did. Now, basically, now about culture inspired, my question refers to. There are quite a few Jewish magazines that also in cooking.
Uh-huh.
What kind having a magazine that is specifically an Jewish kosher cooking when there are other potential competitors on the market already? What makes kosher inspired special?
That's such a great question. And I think it's not so simple. Kosher Inspired magazine definitely was a magazine that was meeting a waiting market, because it appeals to both the Haredi Orthodox market and the more modern Orthodox kosher-keeping market, as well as those people who are in the conservative market who love a beautiful magazine. They no longer want to substitute out. There are many magazines now competing for the same advertising dollars inside the Haredi world. And I think it's going to be a question of may the, you know, stronger and better magazine and the most desirable editorial sort of, you know, be able to be the one standing or the two standing. There is a lot of business. I think that it shows, it demonstrates that the growing kosher market is exploding both on in magazines and on internet. But I do think that Kosher Inspired is appealing to a very upscale, affluent reader who's used to outstanding photography based on regular mainstream magazine readership of food publications like Food & Wine, like Saveur, like Gourmet. And I have to say, for our third issue, the response has been overwhelming. They just love it.
The interesting thing about kosher food is that it's non-Yidden. There is quite a few non-Jew kosher establishments who will cook kosher specific that it is somehow healthier.
That's true, but when you're focusing on the Jewish holiday,
and that goes not only for, and that goes not only for example with wine. I spoke to Jay Buchsbaum, and non-kosher restaurants are now ordering kosher wines are no longer the sweet and sweeter yet. But now they come in all varieties. European producers are producing, which are practically identical, and are winning international prizes. And in some cases, they are winning long-established wines. There is a trend in general, in the general kosher food, kosher wine, and a little bit of taking up some of the customs of eating kosher. Kim?
I agree, Chaim. It's funny that today I wrote a letter to somebody that it's a product that aerates wine and makes a bottle of wine taste even better. And I wrote a letter reflecting almost everything you just said, and that is the exploding kosher wine scene, the demand for better and better quality wines at not a low price, that people are willing to pay more for premium wines and pay higher prices. We see wines coming out of Chile, Israel, France. We know that there's a demand for it. We also know that there are a lot of Jews who are not strictly kosher, but they do go to non-kosher restaurants, and when they go to a non-kosher restaurant, they want to drink a glass of kosher wine. So there are some boundaries that are blurred there in terms of strictly kosher keeping, and those people who eat out in, you know, fish in a non-kosher restaurant want a very good bottle of kosher wine. And I think that trend will continue, because when I first got married in 1984, I remember flying to Paris, and on the way was the New York Times Magazine section, which was, everybody read it. There wasn't as many things to pull our attention as there are today. But the New York Times Magazine, Sunday Magazine section, had an entire section on kosher wine, and that was 1984. And I've watched and monitored in the Wall Street Journal and the Wine Spectator, they always do a roundup of excellent kosher wines, especially before Passover and Rosh Hashanah, making superb recommendations. And as the, you know, a lot of the Baal Teshuva market, people who were not kosher before, who are kosher today, they have had excellent wines, and they don't want to sacrifice drinking not kosher wine when they know that they can get as good of kosher wine as the non-kosher wines that they used to drink. So I think that's an important driving factor behind the market. And we at the magazine, by the way, have been doing a very good job working very closely with Royal Wine Corporation that controls 80% of the wines in this country, the kosher wines. And I think we all want to see wine elevating the food and the meal, and we know that to be true when people go out to dinner. So when people are home, we want them to know that they don't have to wait until Shabbat or a holiday to open up a bottle of wine to elevate their regular, you know, meal. So we are educating, doing a lot of educating in the magazine, talking about which kinds of wines to drink. In the upcoming issue for Passover, we'll have a story on wine glasses, which is very interesting. And I just learned something fascinating about the Riedel family. I met Maximilian Riedel in Chicago at the Houseware Show. And, of course, you know, they make the most beautiful wine glasses that are made specifically for wine.
They make the wine, right, specific types of wines and the glass.
Exactly.
Not
you have a glass for Burgundy, a glass for Chardonnay, a glass for Champagne. They know that various kinds of wines breathe better with an open, you know, more open mouth or more narrow. And they have
or
really
a more closed one.
Or closed, right, to not let the air or the oxygen escape. But my conversation with Maximilian Riedel had less to do about the shape of the glasses and more to do with the fact that he is a 12th generation of his family in this company. And he's a Jewish man, 32 years old, whose grandmother was Jewish, and his mother was raised as a non-Jew during the war. And this guy is, you know, the head of a major company, known, very top wedding registry item. And serious collectors of wine all have Riedel crystal in their collection to drink the appropriate wines out of. But what was the most fascinating thing for me was that this guy is living in Tribeca on the low, you know, in New York City, and does not currently identify Jewishly. So that he can trace his lineage to the family, the Levites in the temple, which to me was the most staggering fact I ever heard about. So that's really an interesting thing. And, you know, clearly Jews and wine drinking have a very long history. We were not allowed to drink wine with the non-Jews and for fear that they would convert us. And so, you know, kosher wine and the myths that surround it, you know, it's a whole interesting topic. And I think that the more sophisticated people become about wine drinking, the more they pride themselves on serving a beautiful meal at a beautiful table at a beautiful Shabbat dinner, that they, as a guest, they're going to bring a very sophisticated glass, bottle of wine that their, you know, hosts will serve and drink and discuss, or if they're hosting in their own home, that they show that they're having this fancy wine at their table, and they're very knowledgeable about it. So I think that, you know, there's a lot of opportunity for wine drinking at the kosher table, not only on Shabbat. 90% of the people that come to my home as a guest bring a bottle of wine. It's easy. It gets used. You know, the host or hostess can always enjoy it, if not then, another time. So I think that we need to bring wine off the Shabbat table and onto the weeknight table and, you know, really get more sophisticated wine drinking and pairing with food to a higher level. Chaim?
Yeah. When you and I spoke about food, not just something you put in your mouth in order to exist, but it also reflects the history and the customs of the Jews, how we adapted the national recipes, how we changed recipes because of the available or being very expensive and so on and so forth.
Uh-huh.
A cookbook, for example, and now they, you know, look like a doctor would give you a recipe, but, you know, recipes that tell a story. A cookbook, it's fascinating how much you can learn about the history of a hell, about a people through their cookbooks.
There's no question about it. You know, we recently had the pleasure, I mean, I represented Gil Marx 20 years ago when Gil published a magazine called The Kosher Gourmet. And I'm delighted, of course, now with his all of his books, but his most recent, The Encyclopedia of Jewish Food, because he himself is a walking encyclopedia, as you know. But Claudia Roden's book is also fascinating. When I was doing research for the Mimuna, photo shoot that we did here for the Passover issue of Kosher Inspired, Claudia Roden's book had a concise and very accurate description of what Mimuna was, and that was, you know, how the Moroccans go from house to house on the last night of Passover eating chametz that they didn't eat for the 8 days of Passover. So I've always been a big fan of cookbooks and learning, and I like the cultural and the migratory aspects of how Jews got their foods and the influences. But I have to admit, though, with all my reading, you'd be shocked at how narrow my own repertoire is, that I cook the same things over and over again. And I think that's true of many busy women who work and have families. I can cook, with intuition, and I don't need to have a recipe necessarily to follow every ingredient, as some people do. And as a result, I see what's in the kitchen, I see what's in the refrigerator, and then I start to, put things together. For many years, I taught cooking classes at the Spanish-Portuguese Synagogue with my friend Carol Basri. And, my specialty is Moroccan cooking, even though I'm Ashkenaz and grew up with an Italian mother. And, I really love the Moroccan cuisine because it incorporates vegetables. It's beautifully presented in terms of color. For example, you could use like a meatball, which we call boulette, and you could put it into an artichoke heart and surround it with peas, and everything is in one pot, and you have a very healthy meal, and it's very satisfying, but it's efficient. And I find that, it can be very long cooking, but the salads, nobody who's a vegetarian ever comes to my house goes away hungry because there are always Moroccan salads. Carrot salad with garlic and parsley and different Moroccan salads that we would put out on the table. When people walk into the Shabbat table, those Moroccan salads are gracing the table. They put color, but they're very healthy. And all of the things that we see being written about, like curcuma, how do you call that, turmeric, green tea, and za'atar, we see it. I went through all the food magazines this month, and I saw so many Moroccan influences that were natural and antioxidant. And we see that the Moroccan cuisine is very logical and very healthful and beautiful in terms of color and balance and style and presentation. But it also has the antioxidant health benefit, which, is coming to light today. So that's an amazing thing to be able to say about a cuisine. So, Chaim,
30
what do you have
seconds
to say?
Left. So why don't you tell us first the magazine?
I'm sorry, can you repeat the question?
Can you, there's a minute left. Can you please tell us in a few seconds how Inspired magazine?
How it started or where it's going?
Kim?
Yes. I didn't hear the question, Chaim. I'm sorry.
How can we? We are almost out of time.
Okay. So let me just wrap up by saying that you can go online to subscribe to Kosher Inspired at www.kosherinspired.com, and look forward to our Passover issue, which will be on sale March 30th. At kosher supermarkets and with Mishpacha magazine. Chaim?
Okay, and we want to thank coming into our show. It was a great thing. People would like to have you on our list. Chaim Schmidt from the Kosher Scene, listening, and good night. We will be back at the same time here on Black Talk Radio. at 8:10 time. Thank you very much to one and all. Good night, and
good night, Chaim. Thank you so much.
Good night. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Two-thirds of the show. This is ridiculous. Right. Right. A few times I couldn't even, I heard you shaking. I do not know how it came through. I'm waiting and hearing. Quite a few times I didn't hear you at all. I'm also going to find out in the morning how many people were actually listening. Normally they tell you every 5 minutes, then, but they are doing some improvements, so for this every it's going to be the next morning. Oh well. They recommend using a corded phone. I was not using a corded phone. Right. This drove me crazy. I hope that's not how it's recorded. Was she listening? Okay. She went anyway. I don't have a three-way. I'm talking right now. Okay. It's archived or... Okay. At times I could not hear Kim. I don't know if Kim was able to hear me all the time, but it was breaking up. I mean, we don't know how it broadcasts. Very nice. Archive, and that show has the archive listeners obviously tweet that the archive is out. Live listens morning so far it's showing zero. It's just the two of us. We will be able to take on the show, which in the radio by Spivak, I could not take in callers. Hello? I can't believe this. The middle it dies on me. Hello. Yes. Mm-hmm. this if I can finish this week in one piece. I'm, you know, clear of my mind. Because, like I said, I had to learn the controls of the engineer. That was part one. I had a lot of other... What? Absolutely. Do I have iTunes on this computer?
who's